Hello, I'm Rafik, and you're watching the Garbled Twistery Channel.
Oh, here we are again, back in the thick of things, and we're gonna talk about the final major candidate for the 1792 election. Who dat, you ask why? It is freaking Jorge Washington. It's Jorge Washington, dog.
So I expect you should buckle up and prepare yourself for 40-something minutes of information you've heard before for the 1788 election. Or if you want to skip that, you can listen to the new info at the 42-minute and 25-second mark. If you don't want to skip, though, and need a refresher about Mr. Washington's entire life, I think we're going to start talking about that right about now. All right, so Washington's mom's name was Augustine and his other mom's name was Mary. Wait, scratch that, his dad's name was Augustine. I don't know, that name seems very ambiguously gendered. If these aren't the workings of a far-fetched conspiracy theory you'd expect to hear from your local divorced man next to a Walmart in Alabama, I don't know what is. He was born in, like, Virginia, like, near a beach. I know, he sure doesn't seem like the Calabunga type. But that beach is nearby, so perhaps? I digress. Jorge Washington, for the most part, comes from a long line of prissy rich English people who got to eat caviar when they attended the decadent live executions in England. It was his great-grandpappy who decided he wanted some freaking Dunkin' Donuts and not Dunkin' Scones, and he hauled his butt to America. Got himself some land and some black people to whip, and his kid did the same thing, and his kid did the same thing, and now we're stuck with Jorge Washington. Yeah. He was a rich kid, but he wasn't handy cocky rich. Like, his family was rich enough to be, like, categorized by the economic class with other rich people, like it's a freaking contest or something, but he wasn't upper middle class, because that would mean he was middle class. No, he was, like, middle upper class, you feel me? Six of his brothers and sissies became, like, adults without the whole dying early thing happening to them. Dying early was quite trendy, if I don't say so myself, so that's impressive. When Jorge was like 11, his dad coughed up a sea urchin, and the doctors couldn't figure out what in the world went on with that situation, so his dad died. And after that, his half-brother named Lawrence took over the whole raising the little snot task. Anyways, Lawrence's stepdad had a kid who liked to hang with Jorge Washington. I mean, our boy George had a crush on the wife of this kid's
girlfriend.
And would write a bunch of sappy love letters about it, even post-marriage? What a creepo! So, like, because his dad died, Jorge couldn't go to a big, fat, bougie school, so he had a bunch of tutors come to his house and stuff, which worked out fine, I guess. So one day, he goes home and tells his mom that he wants to freaking join the Navy. Her response was, quote, "Nope! No, 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 no. You're not going out there, not while sharks exist. But I'll have a gun. Sharks eat those, my child. Not happening," unquote. So yeah, the Navy didn't happen. Anyways, his cool half-brother slash surrogate father gets the tuberculosis, and he's stuck in the hospital, but Jorge kept on visiting and stuff. They straight up traveled all the way to Barbados thinking the freaking air there would cure tuberculosis like a bunch of idiots. No. Lawrence freaking died, and Washington goes and gets smallpox on the cruise boat. To top it all off, he became a Freemason, but, like, not the devout goat blood kind. Nah, he was a snail mail Freemason, you feel me? While he was in high school or whatever, he got interested in being a surveyor. What is that? Oh, a surveyor is a person who runs around with a dinky little camera and, like, pieces of chalk and looks at the ground and sees the angles and stuff. Anyways, Jorge Washington got good at this surveying stuff, and he, like, did some surveying for Mount Vernon, and then some rich dude named Fairfax hired him and told him to go survey, like, all over West Virginia and stuff. But yeah, that was just the intern phase. He became a true pro at freaking 17 years old. Like, He got paid thanks to the William and Mary College. Yes, there's a freaking higher education institution named William and Mary College. Are you kidding me? Just use someone's last name like everyone else. There are like 3 bazillion Williams and Marys in this world. Don't you want to leave a legacy? Shaking my head. But yeah, he was making a whole lot of money drawing pictures of trees and hills. So much money, in fact, that he started buying up a bunch of land in Virginia and stuff. So he was doing that for like 4 years with the Ohio Company. I know, throwback. But then some manly lieutenant man named Robbie Dinny Winnie the Pooh wanted to like hire him in some investment firm that like invested in like land. Why draw pictures of trees when you can bet your financial future on them, right? Eventually, Jorge Washington got bored of this as well and joined the freaking South Virginia militia, because what else are you gonna do when you're bored, right? But yeah, the whole surveying thing ventured into, like, hobby territory. Even if he ended up, like, surveying 60,000 some odd acres of land. Okay, so you see, Jorge Washington joined the military just in freaking time for the Baguettes and Powwow War. Yeah, he and his posse were in Virginia, and he was like an ambassador. That means he was running around, collecting all the gossip in between French peeps and English peeps and native peeps. But the Baguette people started kind of just hanging out in Ohio, even though the tea sippers like already called dibs on Ohio. Which led to the Baguettes and Powwow War, which also, like, helped in causing a whole 7-year-long war on the European side of the globe, and Jorge was just dealing with this nonsense since the very beginning. So, what did he do in the Baguettes and Powwow War? I'll tell you. It all started when Jorge's army boss, Robert Dinny Winnie the Pooh, got this freaking letter from headquarters that said, quote, "Yeah, do you see all those French people over there? The ones in Ohio? They got a scram," unquote. So Dinny Winnie the Pooh told Jorge to, like, try and nicely kick the French out with a very, very fake-looking eviction notice. Jorge Washington, realizing that this eviction notice just might not do the trick, scheduled a cute little business meeting with a whole bunch of Iroquois chiefs who were helping out the tea sippers. You know, for insurance! After the meeting, it was back to the mission. He gave the eviction notice to Jacques Laguardelle de Saint-Pierre. And the response was, quote, "Why in the world would you write an eviction notice in crayon?" Unquote. Yeah, the French weren't budging. Jorge kept a diary of all the crazy nonsense that happened on his trip, and Dinny Winnie the Pooh snatched that diary and called up his publisher friend, William the Hunter. And Jorge Washington got so freaking famous in Virginia that 100 people showed up in person and asked for Jorge Washington specifically to command them. What was Dinny Winnie gonna say to that? No? Yeah, right. And that's how Jorge Washington started being a fun war man. Okay, so for his first commander job, Dinny Winnie the Pooh told him to go to Pittsburgh to protect a bunch of construction workers who were building a fort there. On the way there, he found out that the freaking Baguettes scared everybody off and started building their own fort. Then, one of the Iroquois head honcho helpers, Tana Cherison, saw some French general guy named Joe just lazing about. So you know what Jorge did? He took his peeps and some of the Mingo tribe warriors, hashtag Mingo represent, and he ambushed the crud out of General Joe. Joe and his peeps got freaking demolished, okay? Like, Joe died during this ordeal, and most of his peeps were either prisoners or pushing daisies. Tana Cherison nicknamed Jorge Washington Town Destroyer after all was said and done. Yeah, Town Destroyer. That's a name to run away from really fast. Okay. This made the Baguettes really mad, though. So they, like, attacked Jorge while he was inside one of his own forts and, like, captured his tuchus. They let him go after, but still. Message received, France. Like, he was scheduled to be demoted as soon as he freaking got back, but he straight up resigned because, like, that capture? That was embarrassing, you know? I mean, 2 years later, war would be officially declared in Ohio between the Baguettes and tea sippers. And the fact that Jorge straight up killed a French general might have sped up the process. You feel me? Okay, so a couple years pass, and some dude named Eddie Braddock wants help on a freaking expedition, so Jorge's like, why not, right? We can capture Fort Duquesne. I know that was said wrong in my soul, and I don't care. So, yeah. Jorge was kind of miserable on this journey. Like, he kept getting headaches and was, like, super sick and stuff, only for them to get ambushed by the baguettes, killing Eddie Braddock. Like, T-Zippers were running around screaming bloody murder while Jorge was screaming bloody murder at them to try and organize the whole running away thing. Like, two-thirds of the T-Zippers either died or got hurt real bad. Jorge freaking had bullet holes everywhere on his clothes, and two horses were shot from under him while he was running around. Yeah! Everybody who was giving him a hard time about that time he got captured in his own freaking fort stopped giving him such a hard time after seeing his Shonen Jump, Never Give Up Spirit, at the Battle of Monongahela. Which is the name of the event I just described. But yeah, the guy who commanded after Braddock, Tommy Dunbar, relative of Heather Dunbar from House of Cards, yeah, he didn't trust Jorge with literally anything. And it makes sense, too. Look what happened to Eddie Braddock. Coincidence? I think not. So, Denny Winnie the Pooh was kind of stalking Jorge Washington, and he liked the moxie he was seeing. So, he, like, promoted Jorge to Overlord of Virginia and Boss Man of the entire T-Sippin' Army. But the thing is, like, they were still renegade and actually weren't officially part of the actual T-Sippin' Army. So really, Jorge's appointment as Boss Man of Virginia was more of a PR move, if anything, to try and get the mother country to recognize that their daughter grew up so fast! Yeah, it didn't work. If England is your mother country, expect arsenic in your birthday cakes. Just expect it. But yeah, Jorge as the Boss Man was, like, really, really needlessly tough. Like, he put all his soldiers through a shonen anime-style training regimen. If you don't know what that means, it means cry, bleed, and keep going. Like, this was some 20 battles in 10 months nonsense, and a third of his people died. His hard work did pay off, though, because Virginia came out of the war less damaged than the colony next door, if you know what I mean. Anyways, he wanted to try and get Fort Duquesne again. So he went on some expedition with some guy named Forbes, but, like, he ended up killing 14 of his own people. Oh, how did that happen? Friendly fire. He thought the British army was the French army, and the British army thought the same of his army. What a twat! Like, Jorge Washington wasn't allowed to do anything after that, understandably, you know? How could you mistake your own people? And the mission was a huge success for the T-Sippers. Like, the fort was captured and stuff, but I promise you, Jorge had nothing to do with that. At the end of the day, Jorge never got to be in the true, actual Royal Army. But you know, he learned absolutely every freaking thing about the T-Sippin' war strategy. And it's amazing to think about how he probably didn't know he would need to know that stuff. He learned tactics, he learned how to train and rally people, he was shown the ropes, okay? He knew how to sit on a horse in a way that inspires people to keep fighting, and even though he learned all this stuff, he never fought in a city or controlled more than 1,000 people. Yeah, on those fronts, I guess he'll just have to wing it. Alright, so Jorge got married to some lady named Martha Dandridge. She sounds like a total dweeb, but if the wife fits, I mean, he's actually kinda in love with his best friend's wife, Sally. I know this because The Room is actually an autobiographical film about George Washington. You see, Johnny was his best friend, but he really liked Sally. I mean, Martha Dandridge was actually as geeky as her name sound. Like, she knew how to do some crazy botanical stuff and stuff, so it wasn't a marriage that was in shambles, you feel me? So yeah, Martha showed up with a bunch of kids already, total Brady Bunch situation, and they raised them together. They also raised their grandkids together. Did I say their grandkids? I meant Martha's grandkids, because they didn't make any babies together. I guess in Jorge's mind, he wanted his kids to have Sally's facial features or something. Escándalo! Or maybe it was because of the smallpox. You know what? It was probably because of the smallpox. So yeah, they got a house in Mount Vernon, Virginia, made plants, talked politics, and that was that. No, it wasn't. He made a whole lot of money all because he married this Martha lady. Like, he freaking bought 6,000 freaking acres of land with that Martha moolah, okay? Not only that, but in the Baguette and Powwow War, Dinny Winnie the Pooh promised that the volunteer warriors would get a whole bunch of land. And by whole bunch, I mean 23,200 freaking acres of fresh Ohio soil. But hey, do you know what more land at home means? It means you gotta go to the supermarket and purchase some more kidnapped Africans to take care of that freaking land, right? Like a little over 100 more of them. Yeah. So now he has land, which means now he has power, which means he gets to represent Frederick County in the House of Burger Kings. How did he win that election? Easy. Free alcohol. I'm serious. That's how it happened. Oldest trick in the college frat book. Anyways, Jorge Washington was living that bougie 21st century life, all right? Like, he was out and about the town, partying and going to the horsey races and forcing chickens to peck each other to death. Good times. But then he ended up in debt because, like, his cigarettes decided to stop growing for a year. So he started living less bougie to reverse this. He's not gonna be the poor middle-class American who refuses to believe they're poor so they buy a yacht on layaway. No siree! Like, he stopped growing cigarettes and started growing bread because, like, bread makes more bread, you feel me? Then his daughter, Patsy, died in his arms. She had the epilepsy. It was bound to happen eventually. Yeah, he was sad and stopped side hustling for like 3 months and also hung out with his wife for once in his life, too. But at least he was able to use the inheritance money to pay off his debt. But yeah, he was still very bougie and would have his bougie friends come over regularly to play bougie games like Cards Against the Commonwealth. And he was getting even more super political, too, trying to pass bills to ban English imports and stuff. Speaking of political resistance to the tea sippers, Jorge joined in the whole please stop making us pay for paper phase of the revolution. And like, he started getting a whole lot of street cred when those crazy Townshend acts came around and everybody was yelling in the streets about it. He even wrote a fancy boycott proposal and stuff. Then the intolerable acts came around and Jorge was all like, quote, we need to resist this nonsense until it reaches the point where we are obedient and endlessly tortured like the helpless slaves we own, unquote. Okay, Jorge, for the record, there were slave rebellions up the freaking wazoo from the very moment owning African slaves became trendy, so I don't know where you're getting this helpless obedience narrative from. It's a delusion, Jorge. You should get that checked out. Anyways, he was the boss man of some meeting in Fairfax where it was decided that there had to be, like, a Congress for the entire continent or something. I mean, they only lived on a small piece of the freaking continent, but whatever. The war. So, as I have said many times in previous episode, the hot dog cart on the intersection of Lexington and Concord exploded. And that meant it was wartime, right? So all the Patriots decided to have a second Continental Con. We know this. What I didn't tell you was that Jorge was invited to go to this Continental Con, and he showed up in a freaking military uniform. Like, do you need a therapist for that bloodlust, Mr. Washington? Like, he did the equivalent of showing up to a job interview for a nonprofit organization and reciting the AmeriCorps pledge. Like, what in the name of the North Carolina Tar Heels are you doing? It's not that serious. Like, he's lucky everybody was stressed out about this war thing, because under any other circumstances, everybody would have called him out for looking like a doofus. But instead, it inspired everyone. It got him some major street cred. Like, so much street cred, everyone kind of unanimously voluntold him to be the commander of the whole freaking army. I mean, nobody knew T-Sip and war stuff like he did. I mean, even the first guy who looked at Johnny Adams nominated good old Jorge. Oh, and Washington didn't take any money for commanding the whole army. No paycheck. That takes some real moxie. And as soon as this army became a thing, the T-Sippers wrote this super boastful, trash-talky document that was all like, quote, the New England Patriots are a team of traitors, and we're gonna freaking send all of you to the gallows with our eagle claws, unquote. Eagle claws. I mean, Jorge's job was a tough one, though. Like, he was doing strategy and leading troops, literally, and training troops. Oh, and he lost, like, a good 80% of his freaking battles. Like, he was a big fat loser. But he never gave up. A real-life Rock Lee, if I don't say so myself. Anyways, he hired some guy named Baron von Strudel to help him with this Mulan montage. I mean, he wasn't the head of recruiting or getting supplies. I mean, Congress said they'd cover that. But, like, they clearly weren't doing enough because Jorge was constantly complaining during their conference calls. We don't have enough food this, and people are dying of frostbite that. Why must we, congressmen, endure his endless ribble-rabble dribble-drabble? We need to make our own war committee. And they did. And they hired people to be generals in the armies who had zero experience without even telling Jorge. I think I'm starting to get the full picture as to why the New England Patriots lost battle after 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 battle. Disorganization everywhere. I mean, Jorge did form a powerful posse eventually. This posse includes Nathaniel Hawthorne, I mean Green, Danny Phantom, I mean Morgan, and your boy Alexander Hamilton. I mean, they still lost a whole lot, because those T-Sippers were a wily bunch, but at least a fight was being put up, you know? I mean, every time there was a big win, it was because they had to trick the T-Sippers into bringing an army that they outnumbered by a lot, you know? Danny Morgan was able to pull off a legendary double-surrounded crisis situation. It was legendary because that, like, never happens. Like, never. Like, it's more rare than Lady Gaga's eyeliner. So, yeah. The most important thing Jorge had to try to do was the PR. Believe it or not, it was the PR. Like, he had to make sure everybody was happy all the time, everywhere, and like the whole world was looking at him as the guy. I mean, he didn't want to be the guy, but he was the guy nonetheless. I think it's time to go into Jorge's battles. Okay, I know what you're thinking. We already had entire episodes of Jorge's battles, and I know that. But for the sake of chronology, I feel like I just gotta jump into them again. Okay? So we're gonna start in freaking Boston, because England was the most angry at Boston and wanted to make an example of him. So Washington was doing war stuff in Cambridge, and he realized that his dog ate his gunpowder. So instead of saving his dog, he had to go to the Caribbean and steal a whole bunch of gunpowder from the T-Sip and gun factories. Like, he had barely enough, and he was borrowing most of it from the baguettes, too. But he was able to, like, scare off the T-Sippers by sending a bunch of people to go act like they're intimidating in Dorchester Heights. Then, he took his army to the Big Apple. Why? 3 a.m. pizza, of course. I mean, if you were to pick up a T-Sippin' newspaper, it would have peed on as many Patriots as it could. But it didn't pee on Jorge Washington, yeah. Even his enemies couldn't talk nonsense about him without feeling a pang of guilt about it. So, Jorge is hanging out in New York with his buddies, eating 3 a.m. pizza. The usual stuff. And T-Sipper General Howie shows up with, like, every kind of boat that's ever set foot on water. What was the common sense thing to do? Retreat. Jorge's generals had the common sense to go up to him and tell him to use common sense and run away. But no, this isn't a war. It's a shonen manga where the underdog wins no matter how ridiculous the circumstances. Yeah, the Battle of Long Island happened. There's an episode on it. I don't remember the number or name of it. Good luck. But in this battle, Jorge Washington took his beat so badly that the bugle boy just facepalmed at the sight, shook his head, and never spoke again for the rest of his life on this earth. Like, Jorge was lucky he got to run away in the middle of the night without anyone noticing. And he had a good lead until he had to sit around for 3 days wondering if he should defend the fort named after him. The T-Sippers caught up, and he decided to retreat. So the T-Sippers took the fort, but were able to kill, like, a bazillion people. I mean, it was Jorge's fault for being freaking indecisive for 3 whole days, but he's a politician now. And you know what that means? Instead of owning up, he blamed it on Congress. Now, Jorge has been losing a whole lot. And, like, a whole bunch of contracts are gonna expire for this whole army thing. And Jorge, realizing this, decides he ought to sneak in one more attack. and win for once in this freaking revolution. So he takes his army and swims across the Delaware River in the middle of the freezing cold night, and he, like, throws a surprise party for a Hessian outpost. In case you didn't know, the Hessians were basically hired military peeps that T-Land borrowed from Germany, but it wasn't really Germany, it was the Germany part of the Holy Roman Empire. Yeah, it's a thing. Anyways, Washington's surprise party goes off without a hitch. Everybody got a piece of cake. 1,000 Hessians were turned into prisoners. None of the Patriots died from the fighting. Good times. And Jorge wasn't done there. Oh, no. He kicked some run-of-the-mill tea-sipping tukus at freaking Princeton, too. Mm-kay. And now, any chance that the tea-sippers had of being all like, look, you keep losing. We can negotiate this quote-unquote freedom thing. We're ruined. Dunzo. The T-Sip is lost, so they can't negotiate nothing now. A whole bunch of Patriot soldiers still, like, deserted and used their expired contracts to go home and drink soup by the fire for eternity because it got cold. I mean, he worked with Congress to go hard on the freaking deserters, and that helped with the numbers, I guess. They also gave people who stayed and stuck it out free coupons to Arby's, so there's that. Oh, and he, like, cured smallpox. Oh, well, he didn't cure it, but he saw that, like, 17% of his troops were, like, dying left and right of freaking smallpox. So you know what he did? He started vaccinating his freaking troops by rubbing tiny bits of smallpox into their scabs. And it worked. Like, the number of smallpox deaths dropped from 17% to, like, 1%. Okay. Okay. So, 1777 comes around. Johnny Burgoyne shows up on the scene. This causes one of Jorge's right-hand men to freaking get distracted and chase Burgoyne like a fly to a lamp. But Jorge goes to fight Howie in Philly. He loses. Again.
Again.
And again.
Again.
And again.
Again.
Like, Howie moves into the capital and Jorge can't do anything about it. But also, Burgoyne got himself quite literally trapped with nobody around to help him in Saratoga. And, like, this loss freaked him out so much that he literally quit the war. And France was super impressed by that. So they went public with the whole giving guns to America situation, which really, really, really freaked the T-Zippers out and, like, dropped all the jaws like it was the WWE, okay? But the thing is, Jorge wasn't involved with that Saratoga stuff, like, at all. So some people in Congress and some generals were thinking, geez, all this guy does is lose. Let's replace him. And they really, really tried to. But, like, Jorge had too many intelligent and powerful people who believed in him as hard as Naruto. Like Johnny Adams, whose lawyer skills are some of the best America has to offer, okay? Okay. Oh, and also, it was the Southern delegation who tried this replacing George Washington nonsense while the Northern delegation opposed them. I'm just gonna pause here for foreshadowing's sake.
Foreshadowing.
Unpause. So now, Jorge's taking a quick pee break at Valley Forge. A long, quick pee break. Like, he was there for 6 months. It was cold. And thousands of people died. Like, they were starving because Valley Forge doesn't have any supermarkets. They were cold. Jorge had to, like, literally go door to door begging different states if they had any spare clothes or a freaking cheeseburger. It was bad. How was it for the tea-sippers, you ask? Well, they were on that British payroll, so they were getting massages. They could stop by the concierge lounge for a free scrambled egg or two. I mean, he had to write a strongly worded, thousands of people have died already letter before Congress actually pulled up its bootstraps and took control of the whole gathering supplies situation. I hope this isn't a precedent being set with Congress, this whole letting 1,000 people die before acting thing. That would be quite unpleasant, wouldn't it? Only time will tell. But yeah, after that letter, Washington finally got that concierge lounge. So, spring came along, and General Von Strudel led this whole awesome militarized leadership and development training and, like, everybody was super ready to go shoot some Tories, you feel me? Jorge had a staff meeting, and he decided with his generals to start off the war again with a super cool ninja sneak attack. And, like, it could have worked if two of his generals didn't try to start the attack without telling their freaking boss, tipping off the T-Zippers and making the whole mission infinitely more difficult, like it ended with a draw because of this nonsense. Jorge had to fire someone. It was a hot mess, okay? So later on, in the summer of 1779, Jorge Washington and Congress were feeling particularly racist. Like, there were a bunch of Iroquois people who teamed up with the Tea Sippers, and Jorge wanted to literally ruin their freaking lives, simply because they were really good at this war thing. Like, they killed 200 patriots and scalped them too. But of course, the westernized patriots weren't used to this whole scalping thing, and of course, any war ritual that's foreign to them is beneath them and barbarian. Yeah, that's racism. Like, the Hessians were literally cutting patriot heads off and putting them on pikes, and Congress wasn't all like, oh, we need to burn all their food and destroy everything they used to live their life while visiting America. No, they were still doing war by the book for the Hessians, you feel me? I mean, Jorge didn't plan to kill that many natives, just literally force them out of the homes they've been living in all their life because they were helping out the tea sippers. Like, 40 Iroquois villages were decimated in Pennsylvania, forcing them to move to freaking Canada. That was a low blow, Jorge. Come on, man. So, yeah, next on Jorge's war vacation agenda is freaking New Jersey. He's taken 10,000 peeps to Middlebrook. It'll be like Coachella, but with guns. Yeah, the tea sippers tried to crash the party at first by swooping up from down south, but that didn't really work this time. Most likely because of the Valley Forge training montage I just talked about. It worked! Washington then took his troops on an overnight camping trip in Morristown, where the temperature dropped to freaking negative 16 degrees Fahrenheit and everybody was just starving again because cheeseburgers don't grow on trees, you know? On top of that, the tea sippers freaking snatched Charleston, and Benny Lincoln got fired, and he was replaced with the guy who won Saratoga, which was against Jorge's recommendation, and the guy who won Saratoga also failed to get Charleston back, so they went with the guy Jorge recommended, but they should have listened to begin with. Get it together, Congress. At least France got a bajillion new war boats and stuff. I mean, that'll come in handy. Anyways, let's take a little detour, shall we? Jorge really liked his spy novels. Like, he read 007, 008, even the elusive 007. So he decided to make his own, like, network of SHIELD agents to snoop around looking for funny business in New York. And what did they find out? Well, they found out that Eggs Benedict Arnold Cumberpatch was gonna, like, straight up hand over West Point to the tea sippers when he got permission to be boss there. This Benedict man was freaking confirmed a general. Like, he was a general and he fought in battle and stuff. What a snake, I tell ya. Like, you don't just team up with the enemy because you're not getting your way, you spoiled brat. And he barely escaped with his life for doing that nonsense. How do I know? Well, his partner got caught, and his tookas was sent to the freaking gallows, okay? Anyways, another winter came, and they starved again, and couldn't get any blankets. Again. But that would be the last winter of freaking struggling, because when summer came around, France was all like, we have $20,000 for you, America. Go buy something nice with it. Oh, and we're also sending 5,000 able-bodied war vets to help you out. Happy summer solstice. Yeah, with all that help coming in, Jorge came up with the idea to split up the freaking tea sippers by pretending to attack New York, yelling, psych, and running to Yorktown in Virginia, which already had a bunch of French boats surrounding it. General Cornball, who was the boss man of the tea sippers at the time, threw in the freaking towel after that pump fake. Thus ends my Jorge's long, epic journey through the revolution. Well, actually, none of the major battle stuff was happening anymore, but, like, peace talks are gonna take months to figure out. And there are still 26,000 tea-sipping people with guns roaming the city streets and chilling on war boats. And France was like, well, since we officially won your war for you, we're just gonna, like, go home now. And they did. Also, like, Congress was freaking broke, and nobody was getting the pensions they were promised, and Jorge had to stop a freaking coup from happening because of it. I'm dead serious. Like, Congress had to tell these soldiers that their money would come in, like, 5 years or some nonsense to try and shut them up. But anyways, Alexander Hammy-Tammy was all like, we need a peacetime army. There's too many freeloaders hanging about. And, like, the first peace treaty was rejected by Congress, but then it was edited and rejected again. But then the Treaty of Paris became a thing, and everyone looked at it and agreed, so the tea sippers were all like, fine, you're a country now, bah. And their soldiers, like, went home, and Jorge could eat 3 a.m. pizza in the Big Apple again. Yay! And he had a big old goodbye party with his army, you know? And now my watch has ended and all that jazz. I mean, he didn't have to resign, you know? Just like he didn't have to refuse to take that paycheck. But, like, he was a pretty stand-up guy. Except for the whole destroying Native American homes because they were simply waging war thing. That was shady, okay? He, like, ended up paying $450,000 out of pocket for this war. That's crazy, okay? And he didn't take any money until it was over. Crazy, I tell ya. So now it's time to talk about Constitution Con. Oh, not the Continental Congress. No, I'm talking about the Constitutional Convention. Got it. Anyways, he went back home to Mount Vernon, only to find a bunch of Scottish people hanging out in his freaking swamp. So he took them to court, and obviously he won, because it was his swamp, and the Scottish people left. Then he tried to make a company because he watched an anime and thought that if he tried hard enough, he could connect the Potomac River to the Ohio River. He couldn't. It was a waste of time and money. All his freaking friends kept annoying him and yelling in his ear about this convention thingy, and he was all like, fine, I'll go if you shut up. So he showed up, and everybody basically told him to run the thing against his will. Like, he didn't even want to be there, okay? And he talked about how the Articles of Confetti were, like, super weak, and how, like, some structure needed to happen and stuff. And the reason why he thought this was because the states weren't freaking giving him any cheeseburgers for the war. So yeah, he wants to make sure the Congress forces them to make some gosh darn cheeseburgers next time the states live here. Therefore, they gotta pay rent. I mean, the public thought differently, though. Like, if Congress has control, wouldn't it just be Parliament again? I mean, there was a lot of yelling at the convention, too, but Jorge wasn't doing all that much yelling. Quote, look, here's the bottom line. I'm just trying to stay as far away from anarchy and division as I can, because I want this government to, like, stick around, you know? Unquote. So yeah, a constitution was finalized after all that arguing. And that means it was time to decide a president, which means I'm gonna stop here. Psych! No, I'm not. There's even more stuff to talk about. Yeah, you heard me. I'm going full Billy Mays here! Okay, so I think I did a pretty bang-up job about, like, stuff he did, but what about who he is, Let me tell you something. Jorge Washington, he was a ginger. He didn't wear a freaking wig either. No, all that white in his hair, baby powder. He was also like 6'3", and everybody thought he had super strength or some craziness. And he was really, really good at riding ponies, and shooting squirrels while riding ponies, and doing the whip and nay-nay. And he went to see a lot of plays, because he wouldn't stop quoting Shakespeare like a dork. He was a social drinker, and he kind of didn't like how all his friends either smoked too much, or drank too much, or gambled too much. Like, he could be laid back, but he wasn't a bum, you feel me? He probably had a terrible dentist, because his big boy teeth started freaking falling out when he was 22. He had one left when the first ever election was coming up. One. Why? Well, Johnny Adams said, quote, Jorge, you just gotta stop eating those Brazil nuts. They're bad for your teeth, unquote. I mean, actually, his teeth probably fell out because he was drinking some weird engine fluid nonsense, thinking it would keep the smallpox away. But yeah, the whole teeth thing was becoming a problem for him, so he had his dentist make four sets of mahogany dentures. Oh, and before he had the one-in-ones, he was walking around using a set of teeth that were ripped out from the mouths of the slaves he owned. No, he really did this. He, like, wrote about it in his diary and everything. But yeah, he had to take opium, because his mouth was always hurting that bad. And that's why in every single picture, his mouth is closed, and he looks like he really wants to throw a can of Chef Boyardee at your face. But how was he religiously? Well, at first he was super Anglican, super British and stuff, but then the Patriots revolted successfully, so that fell apart, and he went Episcopal. I mean, he volunteered and did some paperwork for some local church. Good for him. I mean, he probably didn't believe in the whole divine intervention stuff, but he did believe pretty hard in the God knows what he's doing and he doesn't need no miracles side of things. Like, instead of talking about Jesus, he was talking about divine providence. I mean, I can't say he was a full deist, because, like, he did believe God could answer prayers and stuff. Just not with the miracles. You feel me? Whatever. I'll let the historians fight that cage match. But he blatantly said, quote, "Religion is good because it keeps people off the streets, you know?" Unquote. Maybe he wasn't all that clear on his beliefs on purpose so that the future generation can't judge their religion based on how he celebrated it. Or maybe he was vague about religion because he was a baby-eating Freemason. JK about the baby-eating part, but not the Freemason part. That club was all about rationality. So that could explain why he wasn't into all that baby Jesus and miracles Kool-Aid. He was really into the Freemason stuff, though. Like, he got invited to be a Grand Master of the Virginia Lodge and everything. But he rejected that invitation because he kind of had an army to run. Finally, I want to talk about what he thought about the slaves. I mean, he was running around with their teeth in his mouth, literally. So I gotta know what he thought about the whole slavery thing. I mean, come on. I mean, he wrote that they'd all be free and stuff in his will when he died. And, like, personally, he kind of hated slavery and knew in his heart it was wrong and even predicted that the issue would explode and tear the country into shreds. And he didn't try to push the issue because he wants everybody to be happy and agreeing with each other, especially because, like, America's just beginning to, like, be on its own for the very first time. Also, there was just some facts that prove he was acting against his morality here, too. You see, when his daddy died, he had 10 slaves. When he got hitched, he had 36. His wife brought along, like, 86 freaking slaves with her, because when her old hubby died, she got a third of everything. Yeah, 86 was a third. Then, Jorge got a whole bunch of land he couldn't handle by himself, so he got 135 more slaves to tend to that land. And this isn't including people who repaid their debts by giving him some freaking slaves. And he did hire people, and he did have some indentured servants as well. Interestingly, there was a time when some of his white servants skipped town, and he offered a reward in the paper for him. I mean, he tried to keep slave families together, but still let all that whipping and torture happen. And he furiously tried to get his runaways back when they ran away. So, yeah. He says that slavery was immoral and how could America live with itself and all, but come on, you're not fooling anyone, Jorge. Well, you're not fooling anyone except the people who elected you president, but they had slaves as well, so whatever. Yep, George Washington won that 1788 presidency, but what were his first several years like running the country? Well, let's take a look.
From the top.
So, after the very first election, the Bears in the Big Blue House and the Senate were supposed to come together and, you know, do some counting, make sure the votes were all correct or whatever. But, quote, "Come on, the win is obvious, and I have some croquet to play with the boys," unquote. So, yeah, those meetings didn't happen, setting the precedent that government officials are lazy bums. But yeah, at the end of April, our boy George put his hand on a Bible and everybody was all crowded in the streets or whatever. It was real exciting. And then everybody was all like, speech. So he gave a speech. There are like two quotes from it that I really care about, to be completely honest. Only two. Here's the first quote. "Golly gee, guys, you really did it. 1 second I'm relaxing in my home drinking iced tea, and then you guys show up and bully me into running the country. We're so screwed," unquote. The fact that George Washington felt totally manipulated and bamboozled into running the very young country still amazes me. Anyways, here's the other quote from the big speech. Quote, "Look, you guys do all this big talk about freedom and rights that you're born with and this and that and the other thing. I think y'all need to make a bill of these rights, though, so that, like, nobody forgets about them along the way, okay?" Unquote. Good call, Jorge. Very good call. So yeah, that was that. Washington was president against his will. And what did his wife Martha think about all this hullabaloo? Quote, "You know, I really think it's unfortunate how they treated my husband. He's an old coot. Can't they just leave the man alone? And I feel like a prisoner as the freaking first lady. An open house? Every weekend? I need my weekends for Gilmore Girls. This whole ride the country thing just feels like a whole bunch of hanky-panky foolishness. Unquote. So yeah, Jorge Washington, of course, had to do a bunch of things now that he was the super mega ultra boss man. Like fill up the Supreme Court with rabble-rousers like Johnny J and freaking decide on a nation's capital or whatever. Wait. Actually, let me tell you about this nation's capital nonsense, because my drama sense is tingling. So, like, everybody's trying to figure out where to make the capital of this brand spanking new nation, but nobody can decide because, much like football fans, they're all greedy freeloaders who want their own region to be the capital. At first, it was the Big Apple, but that was like a placeholder because the Constitution said, quote, "We knew you losers were going to bicker on and on about this nation's capital nonsense, so you're literally going to have to make an entire district that has its own laws or whatever," unquote. But, like, it didn't say where to put the freaking capital, so, like, everyday people were just making power moves, okay? For a hot second, there were two towns in Pennsylvania that were major candidates, but the two Pennsylvania senators would have definitely gotten into a fist fight, and James Madison was being a freaking snake in the garden, so the whole decision-making process got postponed. Yeah. After everybody took a freaking breather, my goodness, Washington and his buddies Tommy Jefferson and Mr. Madison were all like, let's put it on the Potomac. But Alexander Hammy Tammy was all like, no, I want it in Trenton. The thing is, Alexander Hammy Tammy also wanted to try and get the government to, like, inherit the debt the separate states had from that big freaking war that just happened. But not enough people were supporting that. So, like, Tommy Jefferson had a brilliant idea to cook up some mac and cheese, talk it over with Alexander over dinner. And by the end of the dinner, Alexander Hammy Tammy would be able to get his whole debt inheritance thingy off its feet. And Tommy Jefferson and Billy Madison got to put the capital wherever they darn well pleased. So this thingy, called the Residence Act, was written up that pretty much said, quote, "Hey, Mr. President, here's a map of the Potomac River. What we need you to do is throw a dot, and the closest piece of land is the nation's capital, alrighty?" Unquote. So he chose the spot, and then the people whose job it is to name towns named it after him for street cred reasons, and named the district Columbia, because Columbia was a really poetic-sounding name, and it was all the rage. Okay.
Columbia.
Anyways, on to other business. So one of the problems Congress had right after the first election was a money problem. Okay, I know what you're thinking. Congress always has a money problem. No, but, like, one of the biggest problems was money, because, like, there was this whole revolution that put the government in debt to its people and to other countries simultaneously. And on top of that, the post-war trade with the tea sippers was super hyper imbalanced. So the obvious solution was to tax the people. But a whole lot of people hated this solution. But their paychecks were literally on the line. But we literally fought a war against random taxes. But that war is the reason we need to tax in the first place. What button do we push? Congress pushed the tax button, and Washington signed on the line. I mean, it's not like he wanted to be running the country anyways. So what did the tariff do? It made trade boats with stuff from outside America pay a big old tax. Well, unless it was an American trade ship. Don't get me wrong, those boats had to pay a tax too, but they got the
all-American discount.
Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Of course, they had to pass another act that made a bunch of customs offices, because someone had to be there to actually collect the freaking taxes and prevent smuggling, okay? Okay, so now it's freaking time to talk about Alexander Hammy Tammy and how he was annoyingly good at his job, but very annoying to everybody except Jorge Washington. I had talked about how he had to do a lot of mental gymnastics to cut corners to fix millions of dollars of debt and how the Congress people didn't like his solutions. Well, let me tell you what Jorge thought of the guy's policies, okay? So after Alexander's first report on the public credit, where he wanted to, like, not pay back the promises of money to the war vets in full, getting on people's nerves to the point of the creation of a political party, Washington took a look at the plan, and he liked it. But still, Alexander Hammy Tammy had to give up his dream of the Capitol being in New Jersey to get his stuff passed, right? We literally just talked about that. I know what you're thinking. What about the whole national bank thing? That made people mad too. Yes, it did. Again, Washington looked at that plan for the bank and he liked it. But then he got a bunch of letters saying how it was an overreach and the government doesn't have the right to be touching my money and taxation is theft, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, Horry didn't want to deal with this nonsense and he had like 10 days left to pass a veto, so he had Alexander Hammy-Tammy look at the complaints. The response he got said, quote,
"Did these idiots even read the Constitution? We are a government now, and if we sit around and don't follow the instructions the Constitution literally spelled out for us to do, we would be doing the equivalent of pooping in the bathtub," unquote.
Washington was still like, eh, after getting the response, but he decided to go ahead and let the bank happen anyways, much to Thomas Mac and Cheese Jefferson's dismay. You see, Tommy thought banks were super evil because they had enough power to decide who gets to be rich and who gets to be poor and stuff. An interesting worry. Anyways, now that there was a bank that was going to happen, there had to be like coins and dollars and stuff, so Jorge passed a cute little coinage act to get the money train rolling. Literally. Oh, and Alexander Hammy-Tammy wasn't done then. No, he made another report on the manufacturers. And what was he trying to do this time? Quote, "America has to be a money-making machine. We gotta make them dollars, protect the merchants, protect the companies like they're human beings because we need to be rolled in that dough, bro." Unquote. Southerners hated him. And Alexander Hammy-Tammy basically set the stage for the endless conflict between Northerners with money and Southerners with mom-and-pop shops. Yeah, Alexander was really pushing it here. Like he was literally pushing for child labor. I mean, that sounds terrible in retrospect, but it probably seemed like a less terrible idea at the time. Probably. Oh, who am I kidding? What kind of idiot puts a 4-year-old in a manufacturing plant? They're just gonna get hurt and ruin the machines too! But I digress. Hammy-Tammy's power plays worked before, because they had some common sense, you know? But yeah, this manufacturing push just made everybody look at him like he's crazy. Yeah. And they all tried to, like, get Jorge to fire the guy, but Jorge was all like, quote, "I'm not gonna fire the sleazy money man. I'm not gonna do it. Y'all bamboozled me into running this broke country anyways. You may not see it now, but our boy Tammy, he's playing the long game, all right? Now get out of my office," unquote. I mean, Alexander Hammy-Tammy's absolute need for the central government to be powerful was the consensus until he started making these crazy power plays that made people go full anti-federalist, a position I described in the recent Jorge Clinton episode. So that would naturally make Alexander Hammy-Tammy's side of the political coffee table the federalist side. So yeah, Washington's other responsibilities included filling out the Supreme Court with actual judges, which is a unique privilege as the first president, and to tell everybody to sit down and have a good prayer for your blessings on Thanksgiving. Oh, and the anti-feds hated that, by the way. Quote,
"The president just can't tell everybody to pray over their turkeys. What about the separation of church and state?" Unquote.
Honestly, these anti-federalists need to calm down. It's just a turkey. But they couldn't calm down. First the whiskey, now the turkeys? Wait, did I say whiskey? Ho, have I got half a story for you. So there was this big freaking ruckus that Washington had to take care of in Pennsylvania. And where does it start? With the national debt, of course. You see, Alexander Hammy-Tammy did everything he could with that tariff on the boats, but it still wasn't enough. So he had to put a domestic tax on something, and he ended up choosing whiskey. Why? Well, there were already a bunch of activists hanging around trying to stop people from hitting the bottle, and he figured alcoholic beverages were primarily a waste of money anyways. Like that whiskey money is better spent on toothpaste, you feel me? So anyways, the Whiskey Act is passed, and all the farmers in the western middle of nowhere areas are quite miffed about this. Why? Well, there was no more trade boats coming through the Mississippi River anymore, so they had no choice but to farm whiskey for money. Yeah, they were very, 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 very angry about this. And while there's more to the story, I have to stop here. Election season is coming up, yo. And perhaps this Whiskey Rebellion story will be finished by proxy through the stories of future candidates. Who knows? Also, you may have noticed how I didn't talk too much about Washington specifically. And the reason for that definitely has to do with the fact that Jorge didn't even watch me president to begin with, and he was super, like, hands-off about everything, you know? Like, he hated the parley politics and the whole circus of government. But despite that, the boy was doing his best. I mean, there was a lot going on with the administration, but not a lot going on with Jorge, you feel me? He didn't have much of an angle or a grand agenda. But perhaps America is better off for it. I don't know. You decide. If you've got something to say about this episode, about the podcast, or about, I don't know, Parcel Tongue, you can find Garble Twistery on Facebook and Twitter, or you can head to garbletwistery.net and send a message in the contacts section, or you can email moi. My email is Rafiq, that's R-A-F-I-Q, at garbletwistery.net. Next time, it's presidential election number 2. We talked about the major contenders, and now you have to talk about the chaos. Prepare yourself.
This is the ending. I'm ending it now.
Pooping in the bathtub!